For the past couple of days at Snowbird, hundreds of ornithologists and other scientists representing nearly 100 organizations from 14 countries in South, Central, and North America have been in meetings discussing and shaping the future of bird conservation. It's the fifth Conference for Partners in Flight, a cooperative effort to conserve bird populations involving federal, state, and local government agencies, philanthropic foundations, professional organizations, conservation groups, industry, the academic community, and private individuals. These conferences are held more or less every 5 years, and this year's theme is Advancing Bird Conservation Across the Americas. On the show today, we finish our conversation about what's happening up at the conference and the fate of bird conservation in the Americas with Dr. Daniel Leben, a conservation biologist from American Bird Conservancy, a nonprofit based out of Virginia, and organizer of this year's conference, and Dr. Ashley Dayer, a conservation social scientist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in New York. Thank you both for taking the time again for this interview.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
Dr. Dayer, you are a conservation social scientist. I was hoping you could start by explaining what that means.
Sure. So I'm a social scientist, or someone who studies people related to conservation issues and conservation behavior. So conservation social scientists who are psychologists study individual behaviors related to conservation. Sociologists study conservation related to communities. And economists in conservation social scientists study things like people's willingness to pay for conservation. And I actually do the social psychology part of that in my own work.
And when you say the social psychology work, are you trying to influence the way in which people look at the issue? I mean, what is the
outcome? So what I'm interested in is why people take certain behaviors that they take related to conservation. So what are the things in the terms of the way they think, in terms of their past experience, in terms of what they think other people think in their community, that cause them to take the certain actions that they do? And then also, lots of times, our work looks at what sort of programs could be created that would be of interest to people and possibly encourage them to take a certain sort of conservation action. And so then you can develop, whether it be a communications campaign or an incentive program or a social marketing campaign that would be most appropriate for the group of people that you're working with, and encourage them to take action, or maybe they're already taking action, and support them in that action for conservation.
This is a question for both of you. Let's talk about the human dimension of conservation. Birding is enormous. You know, there's tens of millions of birders in the United States alone, but despite the popularity, species are still in danger, and I'm wondering why. Why is there a disconnect there?
So it's a great question. There are millions of bird watchers. There's millions of hunters out there who are also interested in birds. There's many other people who are backyard bird feeders. And so it is a conundrum. Why aren't all the bird conservation challenges solved? And I think a lot of that has to do with people don't necessarily know what they can do in terms of conservation action. And I think a lot of our organizations are becoming more and more interested in not just doing the ornithological science ourselves, but actually reaching out and talking to people and trying to find common ground that we can all work together on to really start to move things forward in terms of conservation.
Dan, do you want to answer that? I mean, I've got follow-ups.
I think historically, hunters have actually been very good conservationists in that they've been activists. They take responsibility for the resource that they are hunting for. So a lot of bird hunters have created groups that are interested in creating habitat for their quarry. There's groups specifically devoted to quail and turkey and other game birds, as well as ducks. Ducks Unlimited is a great example. And these groups have mobilized their members and their hunters to contribute back to conservation. So there are duck stamps, for example, which are essentially a license, a part of the license for duck hunting. And the money collected from duck stamps goes back to protecting duck habitat and habitat for other migratory birds. And I don't think bird watchers have actually stepped up to the challenge in quite the same way that hunters have historically. They're starting to, and their numbers are great enough that they could do it and have a great impact. Right now, The number of hunters in the United States, for example, I believe is in decline. And so even if individual hunters are still contributing the same amount that they used to, their overall community isn't as numerous as it once was. And so I think bird watchers really need to take up that slack, and they have a great opportunity to make an even bigger difference across the landscape.
I want to talk about issues of defining success in what you know the conservation programs. I know that this is something that George Fenwick from American Bird Conservancy is going to talk about in his plenary session. Basically, systems are predictable. Human beings are probably quite a bit less so. Is there a common reason why people aren't engaged? I mean, you talked about this a little bit a second ago, but how do you get people engaged?
So it's a great question, and unfortunately there's not an easy answer because it is really challenging to understand people. And even if you understand one group of people, there's so many different groups of people who will have different motivations for conservation. So if we talk about birds, for example, some people are really interested in bird conservation because they think they're beautiful and they love seeing them in their backyard, and that's when they're really going to act as if they see something in their backyard, like the number of a certain species of birds isn't there anymore. Other people might be really driven when they find out that birds provide us with services for our environment that are really critical. So for example, birds can eat pest species of insects and help reduce the number of those that are impacting crops, or they can also help greatly with pollination of other plant species or crops. And then others are really interested in the economic benefits you can see from birds. So a lot of chambers of commerce and small towns are now becoming really interested in holding bird festivals because they realize that can bring in thousands of dollars to the local businesses and the hotels and restaurants in their town. So I think it really depends on a given individual and their own interests, their values, and what they think about the world in terms of what's going to turn them on to conservation. But I really believe that a lot of people do have that interest out there, and lots of times we just don't necessarily know the right way to tap it.
Hmm. Dan, any thoughts on tapping that interest?
Sure. You really asked two questions. One, how do you engage people in bird conservation? And second, how do you measure success in bird conservation?
Correct.
So first, I think the best way to engage people in birds and bird conservation is to take them out to see some birds. The birds are their best ambassadors. If people know that they're out there, if people know they can experience them. So if you have the opportunity to join a bird walk, if you are a bird watcher and have the opportunity to take out other people, whether they're old or young, do so, because that's a great way to get people to understand something about birds and from there to learn more about bird conservation. And people can form that connection, form that relationship. In terms of measuring conservation success, I think the best way, the most ideal way, is to measure it in the number of birds. So if I'm interested in conserving the red knot, for example, or a particular species, the best measure of success is the number of that bird going up, or did we take a declining population and stabilize it? And that's not an easy question to answer. Often it's difficult to figure out how many birds there are out there, but that is the work of many of the scientists that are here at this conference.
I'm kind of wondering, and I've read some interesting statistics that a great number of birds are killed by cats each year. How many birds are killed by cats each year? Or maybe you could tell us the list of mortality rates and what are the main causes.
Sure.
Of those.
Habitat loss is still the top threat of concern, because when habitat is lost, that means that birds cannot breed there until that habitat is recovered, if it ever is. So it's not just a loss of the birds that might be there this year, but it's a loss of whatever future potential generations that habitat might have supported. In addition to habitat-based threats, people and what people bring with them often cause birds to die. Outdoor cats, whether they are pet cats or feral cats, may cause up to 2.4 billion bird deaths in the United States alone annually. The estimates vary, but we know it's a big number. Collisions with buildings and glass is probably another billion or so, somewhere in that order of magnitude. So those are the top ones. Hunting kills a lot of birds, but most of the birds that hunters kill are game birds that are fairly well managed. And so we're not really concerned as much about birds killed by hunters. Of more concern are what hunters are using to kill the birds or kill whatever game they're after. For example, duck hunters a long time ago used lead shot. And a long time ago, they realized that lead shot was killing birds, not necessarily when the birds got shot, but when people missed and that lead fell into the wetlands. Other ducks came along and ate the lead shot and became poisoned by it. So they switched to steel and other metals for their ammunition. And so that has helped reduce waterfowl mortality due to lead poisoning. However, big game hunters still use a lot of lead, and so do mourning dove hunters. And so many scavenging birds like eagles, vultures, condors will take carcasses and the leftovers in the countryside and get lead that way. And mourning doves will ingest lead shot pellets along with grit as part of their digestive system and get lead poisoning that way. So that kills a lot of birds in the millions.
We read frequently about California condors dying of lead poisoning because they are scavenging on something that's been killed with lead shot.
Yeah, and your listeners particularly should be interested in California condors because California condors live here in Utah, not here in Snowbird,
right.
But further south, they have been reintroduced to the greater Grand Canyon area, and now they use some of Utah as well. So it's a very important bird that Utah is blessed to have in her state. Also, another really good bird that is here that isn't migratory, but it's important for conservation is the Gunnison sage grouse. It's a bird that is being evaluated for endangered species listing.
That's right, and there's a topic there we could go into, which is that our state legislature is considering a state plan to try and manage the conservation efforts of that.
Great.
What about the rate of extinctions? I mean, how quickly are we losing bird species?
Well, in the American Bird Conservancy's Guide to Bird Conservation, we have a very good figure that it's a sad figure, but it's a timeline of modern bird extinctions in the Americas, going all the way back to the 1700s and 1800s. And I wish I could tell you that bird extinction was this problem of the past, that most of the bird extinctions happened a long time ago and we've kind of gotten it figured out now. And unfortunately, bird extinctions have continued basically every decade in the Americas since. And it's very sad. So for the first couple hundred years, there were a lot of bird extinctions in the Hawaiian Islands and the Caribbean Islands. And there are many reasons for that, but then in the past 100 years, that trend has come to the mainland, to the continent. And so the United States lost many birds in the eastern forest, for example, or a few species, including the ivory-billed woodpecker, the Carolina parakeet, the Bachman's warbler. We've lost some shorebirds like the Eskimo curlew that perhaps was last confirmed photographed individual in Texas in 1962. I wish I could tell you that the Hawaiian bird extinctions, Hawaii has been an epicenter of bird extinction in the United States, and as Ashley has personal firsthand experience, that has continued up until 2004 when the last Pouli died, and it's still going on. We could still lose some more birds in Hawaii. There are a lot of threatened birds in the Andes, such as Peru, Colombia, as well as the Atlantic forest of Brazil.
And in these cases, habitat loss is the main driver?
In many of the cases, habitat loss is the main driver, but in others, it's been hunting or invasive species, invasive diseases in Hawaii. And usually, it's a combination of many factors that kills off these species. maybe it starts with habitat loss, but then some other threat comes in and just pushes the population over the edge. Ashley, do you want to talk more about the pōʻuli, since you...
Sure. So in Hawaii, there's very unique situations associated with invasive species, given that they were an island habitat that didn't evolve with a lot of the predators that exist on the mainland, as well as some diseases from the mainland. So a lot of the Hawaiian honey creepers are really struggling as a result of mongoose, rats, mice, and cats on the island. And so those predators hit those species really hard when they're nesting, especially. And then additionally, disease brought in through mosquitoes is very problematic there as well. And the level of elevation that the mosquitoes are able to go to just keeps increasing. So those mosquitoes get higher and higher elevation. And as soon as they get to that elevation, the bird species there start to disappear because they can't survive.
Is that because the mosquito species are evolving? I mean, is that the idea? They're getting better?
Yes, yes. They are able to be up at that elevation much faster than the birds are able to evolve to deal with disease.
Hmm. The situation in Hawaii is truly tragic. The mosquitoes, it's a very complicated situation. The mosquitoes actually are up at high elevations, and there's only so high the birds can get before they run out of mountaintop. Malaria is one of the worst diseases, bird malaria, avian malaria, not human malaria, is one of the worst diseases affecting the Hawaiian birds. The malaria, for some reason, does not do well when temperatures get below a certain point. And as you go higher up the mountain, the temperature gets cooler. So even though there's some mosquitoes up there, their bite isn't deadly for the birds that stay up there. The birds that used to go up and down the slope and go down into the mosquito zone, most of those are gone. Hmm. But there are still populations of some of these beautiful red or orange or green honey creepers and Hawaiian birds up at these high elevations. They're still surviving, and there are things we can do that can help them, even if we can't solve all their problems. We can help them with the habitat by restoring some of the trees that they need. We can remove some of the invasive animals that are eating their habitat, or feral pigs, for example, cause a lot of problems. And by doing a lot of these different activities, we can help make these bird populations more resilient to some of the other threats that are harder to tackle.
What can people who are interested in doing their own part do to help the birds? What are the ways people can get involved?
So a great way to get involved is to try to learn more about the birds in your area and the bird conservation issues in your area. And you can do that by finding local bird clubs in the area, local Audubon chapters, and also other environmental organizations in the area. And then you also can also do research about bird conservation issues more broadly yourself to learn a little bit about the birds in your area by going onto websites like All About Birds that the Cornell Lab of Ornithology offers. Additionally, another way that folks can get involved is through citizen science. And that way, individuals who are backyard bird feeders or bird watchers can record their own observations about birds and help contribute to conservation. So for example, there's a website offered through the Lab of Ornithology called eBird. And on eBird, you can go on there and record your observations. And now we have so many observations across the country and actually across the world that we're able to really understand bird populations and bird conservation better than we ever were able to before. And reports like the State of the Birds report that's put out by conservation scientists to discuss how our birds doing are based upon that citizen science data that individuals collected themselves. So that's another way in which people can contribute. And then I can't underline enough how important it is for folks to speak up to those who represent them in Congress or in local or state government. You know, getting your voice heard that you think that birds and bird and habitat conservation are important to be considered is critical, especially with the Farm Bill under consideration right now. The conservation programs in the Farm Bill provide more funding for conservation than any other federal program, and it's just essential that we continue to have a strong conservation component of the next Farm Bill.
I'd like to give your listeners 5 things that they can do for bird conservation. There are 100 things that they could do for bird conservation. In fact, there's a book, I think, titled 100 Things You Could Do for Bird Conservation. But let's start with 5. If you're a cat owner, keep your cat indoors. It's healthier for the cat, it's healthier for people, and it's definitely safer for the birds. Cats allowed to roam freely outdoors kill millions and millions of birds every year in the United States. So that's a very simple thing you can do to save bird lives if you own a cat. 2, if you are a coffee drinker, drink Smithsonian certified bird-friendly coffee. There are some other certification schemes out there. Most coffee sold is not certified as anything, pretty much. And if you drink bird-friendly coffee, you are supporting bird-friendly habitats. 3, if you are a homeowner and you have a yard, there are lots of things that you can do in your own yard to enhance it for birds or make it safer for birds. First, you want to try to eliminate as much as possible the pesticides you use in the yard, because those could harm birds that are living there or migratory birds that might be stopping there for only one day of the whole year. Alternatively, you can do a lot of good things in your yard, like planting native plants that provide food for birds in the form of insects or nectar or fruit, and those are great things that a lot of birds can benefit from. So things that everybody can do. 4, everybody can call or write their representatives in government to support bird-friendly conservation legislation. For example, American Bird Conservancy has an action page to make it really easy. It can help you write to your representative on the most important bird conservation issues of the day and reach them and have your voice heard. Then finally, supporting dedicated conservation professionals in conservation groups, I think, is really important, and I don't think there's any better investment than supporting conservation groups, including the American Bird Conservancy.
That's all the time we have today. Dr. Daniel Levin and Dr. Ashley Dare, I want to thank you guys both for speaking with us. This has been a very enlightening discussion, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.